Many of you know that I was I took a trip down to Colombia earlier this spring, and yes, it was a blast. We went down and we did some teaching at a conference for a prison ministry, where all of the people who were going into the prisons around Colombia that were part of this ministry come together once a year, and two of us from PBC went down to teach part of this conference. They also had their leadership team also did another segment of teaching. So it was three and a half day conference, and I think there was like 24 sessions or something like that over 3.5 days. So it was like very content heavy. I guess this is the way that they do things. As we were thinking about what to talk about, they had told us that, you know, a lot of these men and women they get saved in the prisons, and they spend a lot of time in Bible study, but they don't get a lot of training on like what it looks like to be a good husband or a good father or a good wife or mother. So they said we've just had a lot of issues come up, and we could really use some teaching on that. So we were thinking about what to teach, and what we decided to do is teach through the book of Colossians, which has a section in it that talks about relationship between husbands and wives and parents and children. So we decided to teach through Colossians. So we split it up into 8 sections, and we taught through it in our different 1 hour blocks throughout these 3 days. We knew that they were going to be doing some teaching on marriage and family stuff as well, but we didn't know what it was until we got there. So we get there, and I'm asking Alberto, who's one of their leaders, I said, so what is it that you guys are teaching? Because it was all in Spanish, so he had been teaching, but I didn't know what he was teaching on. So I'm like, what are you teaching on? And he says, oh, we're teaching on the 12 steps to avoid adultery in your marriage. I was like, that's a little different than Colossians. And I was like, well, tell me more about what you mean. Like, what are the 12 steps? So he outlined for me basically what they were doing. Was it doesn't really fit his title as I understood it, but maybe something was lost in translation, I don't know. But he was basically going through and detailing what kinds of interactions with the opposite sex are appropriate for different kinds of relationships. In other words, for just mere acquaintances, for coworkers, for friendship, and then ultimately into the marriage, and just kind of progressing through these degrees of intimacy in a relationship. But I was really struck by this title of 12 Steps to Avoiding Adultery in Your Marriage. I've never heard anyone attempt something like that before. But I have to say that when I was preparing for this message tonight, I was very tempted to call it the 2 steps to avoiding adultery in your marriage. I didn't, because when I put it on the website, I figured that might be a little bit strange when people came across it. So I resisted the temptation. But the reason that I thought about this is because in these verses that we're going to look at tonight in Matthew 5, that's essentially what we have. We have these 2 different sections that are tied together by this common theme of adultery. And basically what Jesus is doing is he's telling us how not to commit adultery, which is one of the 10 commandments, the 7th commandment. But he doesn't do it by sort of listing the progression of intimacy in a relationship to give us some clear-cut boundaries of how far we can go with a certain person in a relationship. Instead, what he does is he gets at the heart of this command. What is this commandment really about? What does it really look like to avoid adultery in your marriage? Because the Pharisees had a certain idea of what that was like. And as we've talked about, as we've seen, the ideas that the Pharisees have about what it means to keep the Old Testament law are pretty significantly different than Jesus teaching on what the Old Testament law was actually trying to do. So the title that I settled on instead tonight was Purity at Any Price. And we're going to see why I picked that title as we make our way through these verses. So if you have your Bibles, you can turn to Matthew chapter 5. We're preaching through Matthew 5 through 7 this summer, a series on the Sermon on the Mount. This is Jesus' most famous sermon. This is the longest sermon that we have in any of the four Gospels. This sermon is all about what life in the kingdom of God is supposed to look like, what a righteous life in the kingdom of God is supposed to look like. So this is ethical instruction from Jesus on how we as his followers are supposed to live our lives. And the section that we're in immediately here is one that's often referred to as the six antitheses, which is where Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said X, but I say to you," and he gives his interpretation, the correct understanding of what it is that they've heard. So we looked at the commandment not to murder last week in verse 21. And today we're going to look at two sections. Well, yes and no. There are two sections included in the section of verses that I'm going to cover today, but I'm really just going to focus on one of them. I'm going to focus on the first part, because the second part is primarily, well, the second part is about divorce, which is a topic that we covered in more detail about a month and a half ago. So I'm going to reference a few things from there, but I'm not going to go into detail in it. And if you're interested more about what Jesus is trying to do in that section, that message is on the website, so you can find it there. But we're really going to focus in on verses 27 to 30 of Matthew chapter 5. So look with me at verse 27. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.'" So again, this is a reference back to the Ten Commandments. This is word for word pulled from the Ten Commandments that we have in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. Seventh commandment says, "You shall not commit adultery." So everybody would have heard this. Everybody was familiar with this. Everyone could have just opened up the Old Testament and found this written there. But as with all of the Old Testament laws, the Pharisees had dictated what it looks like to follow this command. Because that's a pretty broad command. I mean, we all have some sense of what it means to not commit adultery. But they wanted to spell it out explicitly. So they gave a bunch of guidelines about what it meant to not commit adultery. And for the Pharisees, basically what it meant is if you just strip down those words to their bare minimum meaning, don't have sex with somebody who's not your spouse. That was the Pharisees' definition. Anything sort of outside of that was excluded from this command in their mind. So that's what they would have heard as they heard this. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But," Jesus says, "but I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Let me say a few things about this verse. This is a stark contrast to the approach that the Pharisees had taken to this commandment. The Pharisees had taken these words and they had stripped down to their bare minimum meaning. But what Jesus does here is he says, no, 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 that's not good enough. That's not what the Old Testament law was trying to do. Yes, it was trying to do that, but it was trying to do a lot more. What Jesus says is what he adds here: anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So Jesus' instruction here has to do with the idea of lust. So I want to talk about that a little bit, unpack that a little bit. What is lust? What is it that Jesus is talking about here when he gives his interpretation of this Old Testament law? Well, if we are familiar with the scriptures, if we've read our way through the Bible up to this point, we would know that lust is not the same thing as sexual desire. Right, that Jesus is not saying here that you're not supposed to have any sort of sexual desire for someone of the opposite sex. That's absolutely not the case. That when we read the earliest chapters of Genesis, God created man and woman. He created them naked with no clothes. He told them to bear fruit and multiply. And he knew what it would take to multiply, right? This was not a surprise. So this is part of God's good plan. This is part of God's good creation. Sexual desire is something that God created, that he has given us as a gift. So this is not something, sexual desire as it stands, that it's not the same thing as lust. It's something good in the right context. So what Jesus is not talking about here is that all sexual desire is bad, which actually is something that the church has taught in various ways at various times, that they've interpreted this verse or other portions of the Bible to try to say that sexual desire is not good, that this is only sin, and that, yes, maybe it has to be satisfied or maybe it shouldn't be satisfied, but at its core, it's not a good thing. But that's not what we see when we read the Bible, that our sexual desire is something that's good. So what then is lust if not just sexual desire? What lust is Satan's cheap imitation of God's good creation of sexual desire. That Satan has taken what God made as good, what God gave to us as a gift, and he's twisted it into something that is shallow, that is cheap, that is unsatisfying, and that doesn't allow us to live the kind of lives that God desires for us to live, for our good. So if you think of a good kind of analogy, I think of the Mona Lisa, right? This famous, well-known painting that people kind of look at and just, she's smiling, is she not? What's going on here? I don't know, but it's beautiful and I'm just going to stare at it. If you were to just take that and make a black and white photocopy of it and then, you know, draw a little mustache on it and a little bubble with some thought that she's having or something, and then you were to try to sell that as something better than the Mona Lisa. Well, look at these improvements that I've made. You know, you can tell what she's thinking because it says it right here. She's got a mustache. That's cool. We'd all be like, come on. Like, what is that? This is a very obviously a cheap imitation. The original is beautiful. The original is wonderful. But what you're trying to sell me is worthless. It's a joke. And this is what lust is like. It's worthless. It's a joke. It's not something that we are supposed to be satisfied by. It's not something that has the ability to satisfy. It's a cheap imitation that Satan has taken what God made as good, and he's twisted it, and he's made it something that is not going to fill us up in the way that we were designed to be filled. So lust is this cheap imitation by Satan. And what it comes down to, if we were to try to say, well, what is lust then? Is lust is when we objectify somebody for our own satisfaction. That we make them an object whose purpose then is to bring us satisfaction, sexual satisfaction, oftentimes. And this can take a lot of different forms. And there are two broad forms that I would say it could take. First of all, let me say, so love is a good thing, right? Love is very different than lust. Love is, how can I be a blessing to this person? How can I satisfy that person? Lust is, how can I be satisfied by that person? It's very, very different. And lust can be physical, or lust can be emotional. There are different kinds of lust. Are you using this person as an object to find some physical satisfaction? Or are you using this person as an object to fulfill some kind of emotional need that you have? Right? I think both of those things can fall under the category of lust, and both of them lead us to do things in sexual relationships with people that we ought not to be doing. So this is what Jesus is trying to get at. That this idea of lust, of, he's specifically talking to men, and I'll say more about that in a second, and saying that it's not just sleeping with somebody who's not your wife, but it's actually looking at somebody with a lustful intent. which looking at somebody is very different than seeing somebody, right? We see lots of things, but we stop to look at certain things. And Jesus is saying that adultery is about when we stop to look at somebody with a lustful intent, with an intent to make them, to reduce them to an object that's going to bring us some kind of satisfaction. So, as Jesus says this commandment, as he gives his interpretation of this commandment, what he's trying to do is to bring us back to the Old Testament. What really was the purpose of the law? And the purpose of this law, and of many of the Old Testament laws, was to uphold marriage in the way that God created it. To make it to function in the way, to help it to function in the way that God designed it to function. And the church today, perhaps rightly so, I think is oftentimes very concerned about the state of marriage, the state of our marriages, of marriages in the church and of marriages outside the church. The things that they tend to focus on as we're talking about being concerned about marriage are the high rate of divorce, both among Christians and non-Christians, about examples of adultery or sexual misconduct, oftentimes from high-profile people, sometimes high-profile people in the church, and homosexuality. Like, these are the things that when people talk about how marriage is in disarray, perhaps, that those are the things that they point to, and those are the issues that they try to focus on. But what Jesus is doing here is he's taking a step back. He's taking a step back and say, if you want marriage to be healthy, where you actually need to start is with lust, with this idea of looking at somebody with a lustful intent. So lust, really, I think, is one of, if not the most serious threat to marriages, both inside and outside of the church. But I want to say, for our sake, especially inside the church, that this is something that we need to be very concerned about. And we see this in different ways that we've seen lust creep into the church. The most significant of which, the most obvious of which, is the rampant pornography that has spread throughout our whole culture, but has invaded its way into the church. That we know that there are men and women that fill our chairs, our pews, our churches, that are struggling with pornography. They're looking at pornography regularly. Maybe they recognize it as a problem, maybe they don't. But that this is a pervasive problem in the church. And this was a struggle for me for many years, one that I didn't talk about with people for many years. And thankfully, by the Lord's grace, I was able to start to talk about it with people and able to find healing in that area. But for a lot of people, this is a really significant thing that is just not being talked about enough, not being dealt with enough. And this can take a lot of different forms, right? This isn't just pornography websites. This is social media. It's Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat. It's the TV shows and the movies that we watch, full of pornography, the ads on websites, on the side of the road, graphic novels. That this is all over the place, and it's something that we need to be careful about. We need to be vigilant about, and we're going to see what Jesus, I think, would have us do in that case, or in any case where lust is causing problems in the church. Besides pornography, I think another way that we see the way that lust has invaded the church is cohabitation, of people not being willing to wait to live together, to have sex before marriage. That's something that's fueled by lust. And just our hookup culture in general, something where we see lust has crept into the church, and it has crippled us. It is crippling us. So this is a serious thing. And I think that if we are, whether we're married today or single or not yet married or divorced or wherever anyone happens to be, if we are concerned about our marriages, if you are concerned about your marriage or your future marriage or the marriage of the people that you know, what we really need to do is focus in on this issue of lust. We need to start where Jesus starts. We need to go back to where Jesus goes back to. Why is that? Why is it that lust is that significant, right? Because this is an internal thing. Jesus isn't even talking about pornography. He's not talking about cohabitation. He's not talking about hooking up. He's just talking about lustful thought. So why is it that lust is so important? Why is it that lust is such a big deal? Let me suggest two different reasons. First, like I said, the Pharisees thought that adultery, if they were trying to protect the marriage, something that we would think is a good idea. They were trying to protect God's institution of marriage. And they said that in order to do that, you need to not commit adultery like the law says, which means that you need to not sleep with somebody who's not your spouse. But what they didn't recognize, and what Jesus tries to point out, is that adultery is a consequence of a prior problem. That lust happens before adultery. That you don't just go out and cheat on your spouse one day. That it starts in the mind. It starts with a lustful thought. So lust always comes first in cases of adultery. It's a consequence to a prior problem. But also, it's a symptom. Lust is a symptom of a deeper problem. Not just a prior problem, but a deeper problem. Lust always comes before adultery, but lust doesn't always lead to adultery. So it's not that the only reason that we shouldn't lust is because we might end up having an affair one day. No. It's that's not, Jesus isn't just worried about whether we have an affair and wants to keep us from getting there. What he's trying to say is that there's a deeper problem. There's a more foundational problem, a problem that sits more at the center of who you are as a person than just what you do with your body with another person. A few Christmases ago, or Thanksgivings, this was, I think, Thanksgiving of 2013, we always spend Thanksgiving out in Virginia with Lindsay's family, and we got a call from her mom like a week before we go. She said, just so you know, I want you to know that when you get here and you walk into the house, don't be alarmed by the big hole in the ceiling above the dining room table. Oh, okay. So they have a bathroom right above their dining room table, and there was a pipe that got a leak and started leaking, and the sheetrock got all soggy, and eventually one day, drip, 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 poof, the ceiling just like collapses right on top of the dining room table. Now, it would have been pretty foolish for them to say, Thanksgiving's right around the corner. Quick, we need to get a contractor in here. We need to get him to put more sheetrock. We need to clean up this mess. And then we'll have Thanksgiving dinner. Because what would have happened if they did that? Would have collapsed again, right? Because the problem was not the hole in the ceiling. That was a problem, certainly. That's not a good thing. It's something that you have to fix. You have to do something about. But it's not the problem. It's not the most foundational or fundamental problem. The real problem was that there was a leak in the pipe. They had to fix the leak in the pipe before repairing the hole in the ceiling so that the ceiling didn't collapse on Thanksgiving dinner. They didn't quite get to that by the time we got there. So they had fixed the leak, but there was still a big hole in the ceiling. But it was okay. It didn't end up ruining Thanksgiving. But lust and adultery have the same kind of relationship. They work the same kind of way. Is adultery a problem? Absolutely. Is cheating on your spouse a problem? Absolutely it is. But it's not the most foundational problem. It's not the most fundamental problem. It's not the first problem, and it's not the most serious problem. The first problem and the most serious problem is the leaky pipe, is the lust that stands behind and before and sits deeper than acting out on that in the case of adultery or an affair. So this is why Jesus takes this so seriously, because lust is something that sits in the center of who we are as a person, and then it flows out in certain kinds of actions and attitudes and different things like this. So Jesus understands this, and he takes it seriously, and he wants us to take it seriously as well. When Jesus starts this verse in verse 28, remember, this is how he starts each of these sections. After he says, you have heard that it is said, he says, But I tell you, but I tell you. And those words are really significant, right? Because what Jesus is saying is that the way that you live your lives, the way that you think about life, approach life, ought to be dictated by me, right? Not by what you think is right, not by what your culture thinks right, not by what your friends think is right. It should be dictated by me. And so when it comes to our sexuality, we have a culture that is throwing all sorts of things at us, right? All sorts of things, saying, this is okay, that's okay, that's okay, that's okay. And it's really easy, without even thinking about it, to adopt some of these ways of thinking, right? It's the message that we hear all the time. So if we're not vigilant, then our attitude towards sex just becomes the same or more and more similar to the culture that we find ourselves in. So Jesus' words to us, like his words to his disciples in the first century, are, but I say to you, but I say to you, anyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Like I said before, this is a commandment that Jesus gives to the men in this case, that he's addressing men. Anyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has committed adultery with her in his heart. The reason that, well, there's a couple of significant things about that I want to point out in what Jesus is doing here. First, in that world, in that context, men didn't commit adultery. Not that men didn't have affairs and sleep with women who weren't their wives, but it wasn't called adultery. Right? You think of John 8 and the sinful woman, right? The adulterous woman. She was caught in the act of adultery and she was brought out to be stoned. What about the dude? Where was he? Who knows? They didn't pull him in. They weren't concerned about what he did. They were concerned about what she did. She was the adulterous one. Jesus says, any man who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So Jesus is leveling the playing field. Not that this wouldn't apply to women, but he's going much farther than his culture would have been comfortable with, and saying this is something that applies to everyone, men and women alike, that this is not, there's not a higher standard for one or for the other, that it's not okay to objectify one of the sexes, to objectify women, but it's wrong if a woman decides that she's going to act out in some way. So Jesus is, he's going above and beyond what the culture expected, and he's going above and beyond what the teachers of the law even understood the Old Testament itself to be teaching. So what Jesus says here is radical, radical words. Let's look now at the next two verses here, the ones that close out this section. Jesus continues in verse 29. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. What's Jesus doing here? Well, first of all, let me point out that this is not the only place that these words show up in the Gospels. It's actually not the only place that these words show up in Matthew's Gospel. Matthew 18, almost the exact set of verses shows up again, but this time, instead of being in the context of sexuality, it's just in the context of avoiding temptation. Not just sexual temptation, but temptation altogether in Matthew 18. The same thing, basically, almost exactly, shows up in Mark 9, where Jesus is talking about leading little children astray and saying it would be better for you to tie a millstone around your neck than to lead one of these little ones astray. And then immediately after that, we have basically these set of verses again. So I bring that up to say that these commands that Jesus gives here, these dramatic, drastic, jarring commands, are not just given in regards to sexual sin. They are given in regards to sexual sin, but they're not just given in regards to sexual sin. This is a way that we are supposed to approach temptation. This is what we are supposed to do in the face of temptation, is to do whatever it takes to avoid it, to free ourselves from it. So, by implication then, we need to be careful not to treat sexual sin as if it's the worst kind of sin. And I think sometimes we have a tendency to do that, right? That if you have, if you've had an affair, if you've got divorced, if you were in a homosexual relationship, if you were sleeping with someone outside of your marriage or before you got married, if you're addicted to pornography, these things are things that we, that's bad, right? Those are, yeah, all sins, yes, okay, maybe all sins are equal, but those are more equal. those are the worst kinds of sins that we put on people. And Jesus talks seriously about these sins, but he talks seriously about all sin. So we don't want to treat sexual sin as if it's this different kind of thing that deserves a different kind of response. But it does deserve a serious response, and that's what Jesus is trying to get at here. So let's take a look again at what he says. These statements that Jesus uses are clearly hyperbolic. Clearly, he's exaggerating to make a point. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. If your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. Is he actually expecting that we would do that? We have a yes? We have a no? A maybe? Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I mean, he wants us to take it seriously, and if that was what it took, maybe he would challenge us with that. But that's probably not what it takes. There's probably something short of that that we can do. But what Jesus is getting at here is that this is serious, and this is something that we have to take strongly. The consequence for this says twice, it's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Now that's not an exaggeration, right? Clearly that's true, right? It's better for you to lose a hand than to go to hell. Now does that mean that if your hand is causing you to sin and you don't cut it off that you're going to hell? No, that's not what Jesus is trying to say. But what he's trying to make a point here that our sexual sin, lust in particular, is something that we have to take very seriously, and that we have to do whatever it costs to break that habit. We have to do whatever it takes to get out of whatever kind of cycle of sin that we are in as it relates to lust. There's a movie that came out in 2010 called 127 Hours. You guys know this movie? It's about a hiker who was hiking near Moab, Utah. He was in the canyons there, and he fell down into this crevice, and he was not actually very injured. The fall itself didn't hurt him very much, except for the fact that he had a boulder that was pinning his arm against the rock, and he couldn't move. He couldn't get out. And so days went by, 5 days went by, nobody came by, nobody found him. 127 hours after he fell, he realized that there was only one way he was going to survive this situation. So he took out his dull pocket knife and he cut off his hand. And that was enough to release this boulder and allow him to get out of that crevice, to find help, and to get back to safety. And he survived. That's ridiculous, right? Who would be sitting there and think, I'm going to take out this dull pocket knife and I'm going to cut my hand off with it? If somebody told you they were going to do that, you would think, you are crazy. But if the only other option was that you die there, you go, okay, that makes sense. Would I have the courage to do it? Would I have the stomach to do it? I don't know. But if it was the only way that I was going to survive, I think I might give it a try. And this is what Jesus is trying to say, right? Is that that is the situation that we are in. That we are in that crevice, that we are pinned up against a rock, and that our only hope, our only answer might be to cut off our hand. Now, again, hopefully not literally, but think about what kind of crevice do you find yourself in? What is the boulder that is pinning you there? As it relates to lust and to sexual sin, there might be several different things. There might be different things that come to mind. But what Jesus says here is not just that we need to get rid of the lust, right? What he doesn't say is that lust is the problem, stop lusting. What he says is lust is the problem, so figure out the things that cause you to sin. That's what he says. If your right hand causes you to stumble, if your right eye causes you to stumble. So what are the things that cause you to stumble? As it relates to our sexuality, as it relates to lust, what are the things that cause you to stumble? Think about it. And then cut them out, Jesus is saying. Do radical things to get your body out from underneath this boulder that is going to kill you. And that might mean doing things that people around look and go, that's crazy. You know, maybe it means for you that you can't bring a laptop or your cell phone into your bedroom, right? Because you know where that's going to go late at night. And you just know, I can't do it. I'm just not going to do it. Maybe you're in a relationship with someone, a dating relationship with someone, and you know that lust is causing you to cross boundaries that you shouldn't be crossing. Step out of that, right? Do something. Make a rule that says, I'm not going to be alone in a room with this person with the door closed. I'm not going to put myself in that situation. And people are going to say, that's crazy. Why would you do that? It's not a big deal. But you're sitting there with a boulder on your arm, and you got to do something to get it off. So think about what is the boulder? What is the thing that is pinning you down? Maybe it's opening up with someone about something you've never opened up before. About sharing this thing that you know is there that nobody else does, and being honest with people for the first time about it. Or taking it seriously and getting accountability, having somebody who's regularly asking you questions. You know, how is this going? How are you doing? How can I pray for you? How can I support you? What do I need to do to help you with this? These are the kinds of things that our culture looks at and goes, oh, come on, it's not a big deal. It's just a little pornography. Right? It's just sex. Like, it's not a big deal. But to God, to Jesus, these things are a big deal. They're foundational things about us. And Jesus takes them very seriously. So we're going to tonight do small groups a little bit differently. We're not going to go to them right now. But I'm going to have the women that are here make their own small group, and the guys will split into some other small groups so that we can make some attempts to be honest about these things. Maybe we have in the past and maybe we haven't, but I think it might be easier if we do that a little bit differently tonight. So that's going to come in just a little bit. But before we get there, we are covering the next two verses as well, if only briefly. So let's make a little bit of a transition here into what Jesus has to say about divorce. He says in verse 31, "It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery." So I'm not going to unpack that in much detail at all, other than to, again, refer to my message from a month and a half or so back that's on the website. You can look there. But what I do want to say is that in this set of verses, like the ones before, what Jesus is trying to do is he's trying to uphold the sanctity of marriage. He's trying to give people guidelines that help them to live in such a way where they can experience marriage as God intended it to be experienced. And it's a covenant that he didn't intend to be broken. He didn't intend for divorce to be a part of our experience. So he gives some commands around that that add some weight and some gravity to, again, something that the Pharisees had made kind of cavalier. And he wants to raise the standard when it comes to adultery and lust, like we saw, but also like divorce. Before I came over here tonight, I ran into someone from church, and he was like, oh, so what are you teaching about at YAF tonight? Like, oh, lust and divorce a little bit. It's like, wow, that's a little heavy. Like, yeah, it is a little heavy. It's a little heavy, but it's really important. And so that's why we teach through sections of the Bible, because it's actually not that fun to stand up here and to talk about lust. It's not my favorite thing to do. But I'm happy to do it because it's important. And because as we learn to shape our lives, to allow our lives to be shaped by these words and to exemplify this ideal that Jesus sets forth, that's what leads us into the kind of life that he's created us for. That's what leads us to find the kind of satisfaction in him, satisfaction in a spouse, satisfaction in relationships with other people, all of which are marred by lust. He's created us to experience those in a certain way. And our sexuality is a core part of that. And there's a certain way that he's set up for us to go about it so that we can experience it the way that he wants us to. So that's why I'm happy to stand up here and to talk about lust, because it's an important thing, and it's a hard thing, and it's a vulnerable thing. And I could stand up here for another several hours and talk to you about the different ways that I've struggled with this over the years. And I'm not going to do that. Maybe I will in a small group with some of you. But we all have our own stories here. We all have our own struggles here. This is something that everybody deals with on some level. And that's why we come together to talk about it with each other, because these are things that we can talk about. These are things that we have to talk about. And these are things that I encourage you guys to be talking about in your discussion groups here tonight, with friends, with spouses, significant others, in whatever context where you have a place where you feel safe. I just want to encourage you to come back to this thing, to have these kinds of conversations with those people in your life who you know can hear them and love you the same. So let me pray, and then I'll send us to small groups. Lord, thank you for this evening. Thank you for the beautiful weather. What was a hot day turned into just a gorgeous evening, and we thank you so much for that. Thanks for Phil and Neha and their generosity and hospitality in hosting us. And we thank you for your word, Lord, for these words that are hard, that are true, that are demanding and are life-giving. And we pray, Lord, that that we would be able to experience the life that you have designed us for by really taking these things to heart and by putting them to practice and shaping our lives to work the way that you have intended them to work. So I pray for these discussion groups that you would be with us as we turn to discuss some of these things. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so I think what we're going to do for discussion groups is, ladies, do you want to be outside around the fire pit or inside?
Inside.
Inside. Okay. So why don't we have the women go to Arwen's playroom? So in the back here, just to the left, you guys will be in there. And then the other groups will, okay, let me think about this. So let me just describe again how we're dividing our groups for the summer, and guys, you can just go to the place that your group would normally be meeting. So if your birth date, the date that you were born on, ends in 1 or 6, you are in group 1, and you're going to be meeting in the living room in the front of the house. If it ends in 2 or 7, you guys are in group 2, and I'm going to move you outside tonight. We're going to have 3 groups outside tonight, so group 2, why don't we just leave you here on the patio or on the basketball court? You can grab some chairs. group three, so if you're, the date of your birthday ends in 3 or 8, you guys will be in, have you been meeting in the living room right here? In the back?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you guys will be in the room right inside. 4 or 9, group 4, you guys will be upstairs in that room. And group 5, if it ends in 5 or 0, outside around the patio, or outdoor couches. That's almost true, not totally. Group 3, instead of meeting in the living room, we want to leave that space for the Crosbys so you guys can take the fire pit. Does that make sense? Sorry, it's so complicated. If you have questions, come ask me. Otherwise, go find your groups.